I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. Today, I talk with Vic Fizell. Vic is a former district attorney for McLennan County, best known for his actions on the 1982 Lake Waco murders and for defending convicted murderer Henry Lee Lucas. Vic gives his account of a wild time in the county seat and talks about his true crime podcast that discusses stories from his legal life and work. But first, it's the Small Business Spotlight, presented by American Bank. A cold gray puddle of a Thursday didn't prevent a line from forming outside of Laverty's Antiques before opening. Once inside, hungry pickers raced to put sold stickers on their favorite items, trying to find that one last piece to tie the room together.
Oh, it got, oh no.
Yeah, it's
always
two things.
It is the heaviest thing. I thought it'd be cute to have. Cute.
Owner Pat Laverty scours Central Texas, looking for unusual items, something she's done for 26 years based in her 18th Street storefront. She loves antiques because of the stories they tell. Letters from lovers during World War II, bowling alley equipment, a taxidermied emu.
When we go into an estate and you start looking, and you know, you buy out an estate, you end up knowing more about the person and their family, and it's just amazing.
Because Pat's taste is eclectic, the shop emanates a similar vibe.
But I've always liked keeping a wide variety of things. We have a real cross section of people that come in here, and so we love bohemian, we love farmhouse, we love formal and Victorian.
Her love for antiques began as a young girl in McGregor, playing with handcrafted furniture in her grandparents' home, and only grew when she moved to Denver for college.
We loved antique clothes. We'd go to Goodwill and pick up 25-cent beaded sweaters and 40s clothes, and I just always liked it.
Though it's not everyone's style, Pat says antiques have a unique ability to bring people together. She remembers being shaken up after the September 11th attacks, and not knowing what else to do, decided to open the shop and see who walked in.
But for some reason, the next 3 months, my business boomed. And it just jumped to another level that it had never been. And I think it was because people wanted nostalgia. It was a really strange change at that time. And I thought, why would this be?
Now, when customers want nostalgia, they have one shot every month. As she and her boyfriend grew older, they looked for ways to ease the burden of operating the store every day. That's when she hatched her genius plan, one that's injected palpable excitement into Laverty's.
So we decided, wouldn't it be so neat if you could just go around and shop and then open a few days and then close it and then go around and shop some more? That's the fun part.
10 years ago, before instituting the limited hours, customer flow was much more casual. Oh, let me think about it. I'll get back to you. But now, if a customer takes that tack, it's likely the item is gone before they can return for it.
It encourages a quick decision, having a big crowd like that. There's a little bit of competitiveness between everybody shopping.
If you miss out on the big ticket items, there's plenty of pocket-sized ephemera to be had. Antique dominoes, Scrabble letters, metal keys. Driving down LaSalle Avenue on a Saturday, you see droves of fixer-upper fanatics frequenting the largest collection of junk shops in town. There's increased competition for market share, and while Pat likes it,
I can feel the pinch when I'm looking for things. I'm going, oh gosh, I used to have this town to myself, and now it's like, now I've got to share it with everybody.
She admits she works harder than ever to ensure Laverty's still sources the best antiques in town.
I like the new blood in town. They come in and they love Laverty's, and we love them loving it. But I love Waco. It's right now, it's the best of both worlds.
An evolving market, a city on the rise, and a woman adjusting her model to fit with the times. Pat Laverty's approach is anything but antique. The Small Business Spotlight is presented by American Bank, with three locations in town, including an expanded branch at Franklin and 4th. Corey McIntyre, head chef at Milo, is in this month for the Chef's Corner. Welcome back.
Yeah, man, it's been a while. I'm glad to be back.
We had to bring you back because it is November, Thanksgiving is coming up, and I know all of our listeners are trying to figure out what they're going to do on Turkey Day. What do you like to do for Thanksgiving?
So one of my favorite things to do is, I mean, really with turkey, people are really going after the breast. That's what people want. I started doing this a while back, instead of buying the whole thing, doing turkey roulade, where you take the breast, you trim it out, you take the skin that's there, you stuff it with kind of whatever you want to. I typically go with like garlic shallots, collard greens, or spinach, and roll it up, roll the skin up around it too, and then just kind of baste it slowly. That way the skin gets nice and crispy. The breast stays nice and moist as well.
What veggies do we have here in Central Texas that are going to be on people's plates? What should we be looking for when we're trying to source our produce?
Butterkin squash is really cool. It's a mixture between a pumpkin and a butternut. You can find those at the farmer's market all over the place. They have a really great meat to them. They're going to remind you flavor-wise of a pumpkin, but more of that texture of a butternut squash. The red curry squash is really cool as well. It's very similar to delicata or acorn, where you can keep the skin on there and still eat the skin, and it has like that nice crispiness with that nice texture of like a really good like earthy squash.
I've never heard of either of those varietals, red curry or squashkin? Wait, what'd you call
Butterkin.
It? Butterkin. That's crazy. Are these new varietals that farmers have created, or have these been around and I just haven't noticed?
They've been around for a minute. The red curry's been around for a very long time. Butterkin has kind of recently come onto to the scene. Farmers are getting more involved in finding some heirloom seeds and crossing them, or finding some stuff that's just a little bit easier to grow. Where pumpkins, people are really only buying those for one reason. And butternut squash, it's kind of one of those similar things where people buy it and don't really know how to use it.
There is some fascinating breeding going on here in Central Texas. And not only on the vegetable side. On the meat side, of course, we've got great cows, we got great chickens, we got great goats, we got great sheep, and of course, we got turkeys here in Central Texas too.
We do have some really good turkeys in Central Texas as well.
When you're thinking about the turkey to buy, you can go to HEB, get a butterball, you can go find a farmer who has a turkey farm. What do you look for in a turkey, and what should our listeners be aware of?
So as you're kind of going through, most turkeys you're going to find are going to be frozen. Turkeys aren't really being slaughtered towards this end of the year just because they've already kind of overheated themselves and need to shed all those feathers and get butchered and be ready for Thanksgiving and for the holiday season.
They were a lot fatter and plumper a couple months ago.
Exactly. And the longer you wait, the fatter they're going to be. More fat doesn't necessarily translate to better meat. So whenever you're looking at a turkey, you're always going to see something printed on there that shows what kind of solution that it has in it. You want anything less than 1%. Anything more than that, it's going to be take forever to thaw out. It's going to be really icy. It's going to be kind of a dry, tougher skin, and it's going to be a lot more salt in there too. So you're going to add salt to it, and then the meat itself is already going to have that solution in there to keep it safe and to be able to eat. If you want to get a local turkey, you can go to richardsonfarms.com and place your order online. They'll let you know kind of where you are in the process and if you're actually going to be able to get a turkey, and it'll be available to pick up at the Waco Farmers Market.
There are going to be a lot of items vying for space in your ovens, so when you're thinking about your turkey, maybe you sous vide it this year. Maybe this is the time we try to fry it. So remember, Turkey Day is going to be taking up a lot of real estate in that oven there. You told us one of your favorite dishes, that roulade. Tell me one of your favorite Thanksgiving traditions. What's a tradition that you love that's special to you?
Collard greens. My family like vies over the collard greens. And by vie, people start out at the collard greens to get as most as they possibly can. And now it went from a small baking tray to like a massive pot of collard greens that everyone is just going back, getting all the liquor, the pot liquor, that juice that comes out of the collard greens whenever they're cooking.
You can find them downtown on Franklin Avenue in the kitchen of Milo. Corey McIntyre in this month for the Chef's Corner. Thanks so much for the knowledge.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me in.
I'm now joined in studio by Vic Fizell. Vic is an attorney in town, the host of the Vic Fizell Show, and known as the man that could not hang. Welcome to Downtown Depot.
Thank you, Austin. Man, it's great to be here with you.
Vic, tell us a little bit about your Waco history.
I grew up in Austin, and I moved up here to go to law school. Went to Baylor, to Mary Hardin Baylor for undergrad. And when I finished law school, I was too broke to move back home. And back then, there were lawyers pumping gas in Austin. They still had full-service gas stations back then.
And what year would this have been?
This was 79. And so I had a law professor who really liked me. He found a job for me in Galveston with a defense firm, insurance defense. But I just didn't want to do that. That's not my bend. So I turned that down, to go out and borrow $5,000 from the bank and open my own little practice. Practice out of the trunk of my car for the first month or so, and then started renting some office space from a couple other lawyers and just built it from there. Mostly in the beginning with criminal appointments. I tried them back to back. Back then, you could take the bar exam before you graduated if you had so many hours, and I did. This before the internet, so I had to wait to get my bar scores in the mail. They came in the Saturday I graduated. That Monday, I was in front of District Judge Carl Anderson here in 54th Court at the Waco Courthouse. Had him swear me in, and I said, now appoint me on a case. He said, I can't do that. You just graduated. I said, give me a shot. So he did. He and Judge John Kavnis got together and figured out one for me to try. Said, only problem, it goes to trial in 10 days. And so I did my first jury trial 10 days after graduating. And I won it.
I love the way that you framed that, because from what I've read about you and what I've listened to on your show, you seem like a man who from day one has been willing to bet on himself. You'll take a case that somebody else didn't want. You'll tell him, give me a job. I'll take it even though it's 10 days from now. That seems almost emblematic of your career.
It is, and I don't think it's because of courage or anything like that. I think it's just because I don't know any better. Growing up, my dad used to call me Goose. He said, you wake up in a new world every day. You're just like a goose, because a goose never remembers anything from day to day. So I've just been willing to take chances, and I believe in people. I want to be on the right side of things. And so I'll take a hard case. The way I met my mentor, my friend Gary Richardson, he's a great trial lawyer in Tulsa. And he had a case here that no one would take. It was in 1979. I had just graduated because it was against a local bank. That's back when all the banks were locally owned, before, you know, all the big chains and conglomerations came along. And he came to town looking for local counsel just to help him out on this case, and went to six lawyers who turned him down. They wouldn't take it because they all owed money to this bank. But he said, you might want to try that kid down the street. And so he came to see me, and I took that case, and that started it. That was a big verdict for a little guy. And then it just kept going from there. And then later, Gary defended me in my criminal case and represented me in my suit against Bigelow.
In a town like Waco and its size, it's hard to get away from people. They're going to end up circulating back into your system. Was that something that you considered when you were deciding whether or not to take this case, knowing that I'm going to burn some bridges along the way? Or was this quest for justice great enough that it was worth whatever brushback you might get?
It was a quest for justice because I liked our client. I believed his story. I really liked working with Gary Richardson. I learned a lot from him. But unless it's a snake, I'm just not scared of anything. And that's not any kind of courageous thing. It's just the way I'm wired. I don't even have a startle reflex unless it's a snake. And so I've just gotten into stuff before I realized what I was in. I mean, I took on the Texas Rangers. I took on the FBI before I realized what I was into, you know? But God always blesses me, and it seems to work out. Now, with age, I've gotten a little wiser about what I say and some of the cases I'll take. But I have a good staff, and they handle some of those cases, and then I'll step in once it gets to trial.
Graduated from Baylor Law in 1979, started working cases in town. You eventually, in the 80s, ascended to the position of district attorney.
I ran for DA. I did. I'd been practicing for about 2 years, and I'd win these jury trials back-to-back. I mean, court-appointed cases mostly, but I had a long streak of wins. And I decided it might be fun to run for DA. It's kind of a personal vendetta. I hate to admit this, but I had been court-appointed on a case. I went up to the DA's office. The first assistant had been assigned to it. I waited over an hour past my appointment time. Then he comes out into the lobby. He had alcohol on his breath. He yelled at me, told me I was as sorry as my client if I was going to represent somebody like that. And I could smell the alcohol in it. And I didn't even know this guy. I knew he was a big shot, you know, but I'd never met him before. And just on a impulse, I said, you know what? I'm going to run for DA. That's what got me into politics and why I ran for DA.
We all have different poles to where we're supposed to be, and I think everyone in Waco is grateful, and it's particularly people of the true crime variety who like stories such as the ones that you've tried. They love the fact that you're there and that you're willing to go the extra mile and go as far as to exonerate someone or to prove someone else is the wrong case and you weren't. The name Lucas looms large in your history. Can you connect some of these dots for me?
All right. When I was DA, I got a phone call from a Texas Ranger. And he said, Henry Lee Lucas has confessed to some murders in your county. I knew who Henry was. I'd been watching the news for a year and a half with him walking around pointing. And they say he led us to another body. Or he confessed to another murder. Lucas has killed 100 women. And then the next headline is Lucas has confessed to killing 200 women. I mean, it was getting ridiculous. So when they called me and told me he had confessed to one in our county, I wanted to read the confession. I wanted to look at the file. They said, oh, just let us come up, indict him, plead him guilty, get on TV, get your picture taken. You know, we'll have our good PR and we'll be on our way. So I read the confessions. And there were more than one confession. And this was a case, the murder case of Rita Salazar, a little teenage girl who had been, she and her boyfriend had run out of gas on I-35. He was murdered there, shot. She was kidnapped, brought up to Hewitt, and shot and left on I-35, beside I-35 in Hewitt. So that was in McLennan County. And I'm reading these confessions, one by Henry, and then another one where Otis Toole had confessed to this same murder, and that Henry and Otis had been friends in Jacksonville, Florida. And they had this false reputation of having gone around the country murdering thousands of people. Henry even claimed at one point that he had driven the Kool-Aid to Jim Jones in Guyana. He claimed he drove to Japan and killed some people. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I'm looking at these confessions, and they don't make sense. And I will not bring him up to plead, even though I would get my picture taken with a Texas Ranger. You know, I'd be in the paper. They call me again. So I had an investigator who was working in my office. He worked for Jack Harwell, our sheriff. He was a captain in the sheriff's office. But he had a great homicide investigator. He had worked for the police department for years. His name is Truman Simons. He's the guy who actually solved the Lake Waco triple murders. And there's a great book about that called Careless Whispers. But I asked Truman, I said, look into this, Truman, see what you can find. We didn't have computers back then. We had this one little green box that was connected to something called TCIC, and that was the Texas Criminal Records. And it was also connected to the NCIC, the National Criminal Records, up at the FBI headquarters. And so I had him digging through there, just seeing if he could find anything on Lucas, his whereabouts. He comes back a few days later and says, Vic, man, I still don't know anything about this murder, but look at this. And he lays out a sheet of paper for me with some cleared cases that Henry had confessed to, yet with proof over here in this other column where Henry had been in other places. He was in jail at one time. He was in a hospital at another time. He was in a dentist chair at another time. And we were finding these records. It was hard work because back then you had to get on the phone a lot. We'd get a little hint from the NCIC, and we'd have to get on the phone and call and get papers faxed to us. But he had like 10 murders already that Lucas couldn't have done. And I'm thinking, why didn't the Texas Rangers figure this out, you know? So I talked to our judge, George Allen, and we decided it might be a good idea to let a grand jury look at this. How did this guy confess to this murder if it looks like he didn't do it? And one of the things that bothered me about that confession is he and Otis both had, in their confessions, they had said two children were in the car with them when they murdered these people, a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. Well, we got their school records to prove that they were in school that Friday and that Monday. Nothing wrong. You know, they lived in the house in Jacksonville. with Henry and Otis. And I just didn't believe that that murder would take place with those little kids in the car, and they could be at school Monday morning like nothing ever happened, you know? Maybe in a B-horror movie, but not in real life. No. So our grand jury started looking into it, and that's when the ship hit the sand. They came after me with a vengeance, man. I've got letters that we've saved and digitized. Jonathan's in the room here with me. He's been my archivist for the last 14 years. And threatening letters that were sent, even one from a Texas Ranger that was written to the newspaper about me. They got Channel 8 involved doing a smear thing on me because the head of the state police back then was a guy named Colonel Jim Adams. And Jim Adams had been the former deputy director of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. He was head of the domestic spy program. He's the one that did the dirty tricks, or was his agency, his part, did the dirty tricks on Martin Luther King, a bunch of dirty tricks on all the Vietnam War protesters, civil rights activists. And then he pulled some of those same things on me. That's how I ended up getting arrested. Led away in handcuffs. You know, there's that iconic photo of me with my thumbs up with the handcuffs on. And I was looking at 80 years in prison. So, yeah, Henry played a big part in my life.
This story of working with Mr. Lucas is a long one, one that is worthy of everyone in Waco, anyone interested in true crime, to check out. So I would encourage you, one, you talk about this on the podcast, the Vic Fiesel Show.
We do.
Secondly, there is a major streaming service that will be releasing a documentary in November.
You know, I wish I could talk about that. I'm still under a non-disclosure agreement until mid-November. But yeah, watch for some advertising coming out in November, late November, about a documentary that if I talked about it, this streaming network's lawyers would chase me across Mr. Trump's wall and I'd have to hide out in Mexico.
Well, we will be sure to blast that as it airs. You can always follow us on Facebook and on Instagram at Waco Business News. Vic, the idea that you had of justice graduating as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young attorney in 79 to where you were 10 years later, 20 years later, 40 years later, how has your conception of what justice is and our ability to actually achieve a modicum of justice with the current system, how has that evolved?
You know, I think that things are improving. Now, most everybody else thinks things are getting worse. I just think we're more informed now. This kind of bad stuff with people getting killed by police and policemen getting killed themselves and innocent people being found guilty, you know, innocent people serving long sentences, that's always been going on. Always. And I think it was worse before than it is now. We have more rights now. And I thank God for video, for body cam, for dash cam, all that stuff, because it's made everybody have to be more honest. I mean, used to, if a policeman said, that guy swung at me before I hit him, everybody believed the policeman. Well, now we've got video. Did it happen? Did it not happen? You know, and it also helps, you know, we've got all this security video around. They're catching people better with better evidence. And we've got DNA now. The murder I was talking about a while ago, Rita Salazar, where she was dumped in the ditch in Hewitt. Her case, 30 years later, was solved with DNA. And the guy who actually killed her is in prison now. He also confessed to killing her boyfriend, Frank Key. His DNA, 30 years later, was found on Rita Salazar's underwear that somebody had the presence of mind to seal in a Sealamil bag. And so it had been preserved. And now the real killer is in prison. If I hadn't dug my heels in, when I put my thumbs up, and I said to the camera, you know what's going on here, and I'll still be proven right. Well, oh my God, 30 years later, when that DNA came out, because I was talking about Rita Salazar when I said that, because that's the reason the grand jury started. And 30 years later, yeah, for it to come full circle like that, and I was proven right, and found not guilty, and sued Belo for the smear campaign they did on me and got the largest libel verdict in history. It's in the Guinness Book, yeah.
If you were a young man set to graduate law school in 2019, is there a particular area of work right now that's exciting to you that maybe wasn't around in 79?
I think I'd be a veterinarian.
Just get in out of the field completely.
Yeah. Law is tough. Law school is hard. There are a lot of lawyers out there. We make a lot of our money on car wreck cases. That's what keeps the lights on, so then I can go off and handle business lit, criminal cases I'm interested in, that sort of thing. The car wrecks keep the lights on. But in 10 years maybe, that's not even going to be a business anymore. Google's going to be driving all our cars. We might have products liability cases, but we're not going to have negligence cases against drivers anymore. It's just going to go away. So that's going away. Libel has, since I won my verdict, it's pretty much gone away. They changed all the laws. They called it the Vic Fizel package in the legislature because they didn't want that to ever happen again. The U.S. government, they even changed the tax code after that and made libel verdicts taxable. They weren't taxable before. Not only did they make it taxable, but they made that law retroactive to catch me up in it 5 years later after I'd been going around buying cars for people like I was Elvis, you know, and even bought a house and gave it to the Catholic Diocese in Austin for a homeless shelter. I mean, I spent money like crazy. And then here comes the IRS 5 years later saying, you owe us all of it. I filed a suit in the tax court. 12 judges on that court. All 12 wrote on it. I won 11 to 1. The government appeals to the Fifth Circuit. There I lost 2 to 1. And we're bringing up this ex post facto law. It's unconstitutional. So after we lost in the Fifth Circuit, we appealed to the Supreme Court, and I lacked one vote having it taken up. So now that's the law. Retroactive. We quoted Oliver Wendell Holmes, the power to tax is the power to destroy. And they go, yeah, except IRS. What? So they made a retroactive law to catch me up in it. And it's also really hard to win a libel case now. But business libel, I'm looking at a business libel case right now, because if you're a business suing a business, you still have a chance to win and keep it.
What do you think it was, either about the cases you're working on or about you in particular, that made you such an attractive target for these major institutions?
Well, because I embarrassed the hell out of them on Henry Lee Lucas. See, if I hadn't dug my heels in on Rita Salazar, none of that would have ever come out. When I did that, that was national news. It was on everything. Good Morning America, you know, think of all of them. It was on all of them. So jurisdictions around the country started reopening those Lucas cases. And so they're not closed cases anymore. They're cold cases, which means they'll still take a look at it. That's how Rita later got solved, her murder. Hopefully someday they'll solve the Ornsox murder, because now we know who she was through DNA. She'd been called Ornsox for 40 years. Now we know her name was Deborah Jackson. They found DNA on the socks. We might be able to find who the murderer is.
Vic Fizel is an attorney working here in Waco, former district attorney in McLennan County, and you can find his podcast online, The Vic Fizel Show, where he digs in so much more to your history, working in law, and if anyone is interested in true crime, I would suggest they check it out.
It's a lot of fun. We talk a lot about true crime, and it's a primary source podcast. We talk about people I've known and cases I've handled. And we're spending a lot of time on Lucas. We may talk about Bundy some, because I'm friends with the guy who wrote the book, Only Living Witness. He's actually been on our podcast, Hugh Ainsworth. We had 4 episodes with him.
Vic Fizel, thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot.
You are welcome. It's great to be here, Austin. Thank you.
Thanks again to Vic Fizel, Pat Laverty, American Bank, Corey McIntyre, and you for tuning in. I especially want to thank our Downtown Depot listeners who gave to KWBU during the recent big membership event. With your help, the station set records for total amount raised, over $60,000, and registered 70 new members. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.